From grandmothers who whispered in their baby girl ear, to fathers on dimly lit street corners instructing young soldiers to always keep their eyes open. You be queen. You were fire. You were passed through centuries on the hands of your daughters. They called you wisdom. Proverbs. On the backs of diamond-eyed school children who grew into hymnals recited by amethyst-holding urban philosophers who recited neighborhood commandments out of the windows of restored El Camino chariots to keep the warmth in their blood. Be wise. Be smart. Be black opal, brown quartz, bloodstone, and prayer. Be every form of gem. See, king told scribe, scribe told son, son told wife, wife told her daughter, and daughter told the ancestors, and the ancestors told me that you would come to give wisdom to thousands. They said you would come, dropping gem, dropping gem.
Welcome back. We're on episode 20 of the Dropping Gems podcast. I'm your host, Debbie Brown. Guys, today I really want to deepen our journey with the concept of joy. Joy has become a significant part of my life, especially in this very unique time. So I would say the last 7 months especially, I have completely revolutionized my spiritual practice, and it is sitting inside of, engulfing, just radiating with joy. And it has been such a major, major catalyst for transformation I hadn't experienced yet. So I really want to speak to that today with you guys. We're going to have a special guest joining us a little bit later in the show who I love and who I just think is just absolutely brilliant and incredible. And I'll get to her in just a bit and give you that full understanding of all the power that she stands in. But when we think about joy, you know, I think it's really important for us, and we're going to explore this through the show, many, many episodes, and do a lot of beautiful unpacking. But I think it's really important for us as we are on our different journeys or as we're experiencing ourselves in new ways to always question, what effect has colonialization or patriarchy or systemic racism or capitalism had on the way I experience healing or the way I allow myself to experience myself? I think for women, and especially women of color, we have always been pushed into this false belief that love has to be earned, that life is painful, that it just is, and that we are not allowed to feel or process in real time, that all we can do is go into this path of forced resilience where we are just focused on how strong we are and staying strong and not gifting ourselves opportunities for tenderness and softness. And I, for one, and I've talked about this in previous episodes, but I had a really significant breakthrough on my journey a couple of years ago. And that's the really beautiful and divine thing about this journey, right? You think you've healed something, and then you notice that you're triggered again. And what it really is, it doesn't mean that you haven't healed or you didn't do all that work. It really just means now there's opportunity to deepen that healing and to deepen that understanding. So a couple of years ago, something that came forward for me that was really revolutionary in the way that I saw myself and created quite a shift in the new system of ways I would work with my spirituality were, it was really focused on having this veil lifted on myself of the way that I experienced me. And for me, that came in understanding that my identity, my value system was so wrapped up in how much pain I could tolerate and how strong I was perceived as and how many things I was fixing for other people and fixing for myself. And what I really came to understand is that although those facets of my personality were something I really was proud of and really treasured. You know, none of us, we all have challenges, right? And my strength and my ability to aid others, my ability to be this fixer, be a little more enlightened sometimes than some of the areas I was in, you know, that was something I was really proud of. It's something that helped me survive. But I also saw that in that same vein, it was so limiting, and it kept me from really being able to expand and stretch open my heart. And so I didn't want to live a life where my value was measured by how much pain I could tolerate, or my value was measured by how resilient I was. Dev's so strong. She's so strong. And you're the strong friend. And, you know, all those things that a lot of us experience or we see funny memes made about on Instagram. You know, I didn't want that to be my life anymore. I've always been a really enthusiastic and exuberant person. But I realized that there was a deficit of joy in my life. I didn't really understand what joy even was. Is it the same thing as happiness? Is it I'm just walking around celebrating all day? You know, I didn't quite understand how to implement it in my life and learn to embodiment. So for the last 2 years, I have been on a journey of joy. And coming into this very unique moment in time, you know, we keep referencing this, you know, unprecedented times, global pandemic, election, all of the ways in which we're meeting ourselves more deeply because of the isolation and the uncertainty. You know, the last 7 months really gave me this gorgeous gift of some pretty agonizing pain, but also learning how to transmute that pain with joyousness. So if you follow me on Instagram or you are part of my Karma Gang community on karmabliss.com, then you know I am always talking about finding the tiny joys, finding the moments, big, small, grand, private, to really savor the present moment, to really connect to the gratitude of each moment and truly find worth and depth in literally everything and anything. So for me, that is how I've begun to cultivate and experience more joy in my life. And before we get into our guests, we're going to have so much to talk about, and we're going to really be on this show so often exploring joy, whether that is, you know, joy through celebration or joy through pleasure or new ways to make our journeys feel better from the inside out. We're going to get into so much of that over the next many, many episodes. But today I really want to focus in on how do we perceive joy? So the working definition for joy, it's joy is a feeling of great pleasure and happiness. The way that I experience it is more so as this interesting combination of peace and celebration at once. And sometimes that feels a little conflicting, right? Because we're kind of taught that peace means like being very, like, you know, I'm still and I'm silent and I'm kind of unmovable to the storms of life. But I experience peace really as just gorgeous, deep knowingness and surrender. And so when I experience joy, for me, it feels like deep, deep peace and also exuberant celebration. Like really just, oh my gosh, I am so warm and on fire from my own life inside of my body. So, you know, I think also too, a lot of times when we're thinking of joy, it's so often equated with what we assume happiness is. And so sometimes it's hard to grasp what joy can be in our life, because if you're having a bad day or a perceived bad day, you're saying, well, I'm not happy. So how do I have joy? I'm not happy about this. I'm not happy about that. And I think it's important to know that, you know, when we think of joy, when we think of happiness, happiness for me often needs a catalyst of some sort. When we think of that emotion, I am happy, happiness. You know, it's really something that quite often requires a catalyst. Versus joy is experienced as more of a deep aboding, an embodiment. So from the depths of you radiating out into the world, I experience joy also as just this state of euphoria in the midst of being in full surrender and in full trust, which means I am leaning into fully the knowingness that life was designed to be uncertain, that we don't control anything other than how we feel about and treat ourselves. So for me, that feels like joy. And I think, you know, it's interesting as I even dive into and develop more of my relationship with joy, I always come back to this one particular passage in the Bible. And you guys know I'm a lover of so many belief systems and so many sacred texts and so many, you know, ascended masters and saints and just embodiments of the divine. But when I think of joy in this moment, in the moment that we're in the country, in the moment that we're in with ourselves, I think of this passage from 2 Corinthians, which was, and I probably shared this on a really early episode of the show, but when I was in a really difficult, challenging state in my life 8 years ago, this was the passage that made me understand what faith was and what surrender was. And you know, every time we reread something over the years with new circumstances, we're able to deepen our connection to it. And so in this moment, this passage for me also represents the freedom and the ability to choose that we have in all moments and the joy that we can connect to even in the midst of profound suffering and pain. And so 2 Corinthians, a passage in it says, "I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong.'" Oh, I love that. I love that. This passage means so much for me, especially in 2020, you know, finding ways to have joy anyway, finding ways to feel good about yourself and your life, regardless of everything that feels like it's falling down all around us. So the first time that I really started actively pursuing joy. Like, I don't mean I'm just passively allowing, perhaps I'll have some joy today, it'll flow in and out. I mean, I am in hot pursuit of joy in every moment. Like, I am delightfully chasing it and, you know, playing hide and seek with it in every day and every moment. And that really kicked off for me at the top of this pandemic. So April, May-ish, you know, life was so radically shifting for me personally, professionally, also global, all the things, right? All the things we're familiar with now. And I said, I can't survive this without cultivating more joy. And raising my son with joy is something that is so significant and important for me. And so to do that and to do it authentically, I knew I had to find new ways to fill my cup and to supercharge my experiences of my spirituality. So for me, finding joy looks like going outside. And when I feel that sun on my face, on my skin, when I get a faint smell of something lovely, you know, going to pass my nose or the wind hits my face, taking a moment to savor it, taking time to savor myself and to savor my day. And it could be seconds, it could be minutes, but really just saying, oh, that feels good. And taking a moment to root and anchor in that feeling and really accept that feeling and allow myself the gift of it. So that's what I love to do really in each moment as I'm in the world and privately as part of my spiritual practice. Joy for me really looks like every single night after I put my kiddo to bed, turning on, you know, an epic playlist of some sorts that feels really good, lighting some candles, making some offerings, and then just dancing and letting myself be free and letting myself build my own happiness and build my own joy. And that's what I think is so important too about our spiritual practices and our connection to joy as we grow, as we transform, as we heal. You know, it really teaches you the deeper understanding of how to self-regulate, to where I don't need a catalyst to feel good about myself or my life. My day doesn't even have to be technically going well by comparative standards for me to still feel good as hell about me. And that comes from really anchoring your identity in your spirit and not in the roles that we play and not in the things we are for other people, not even in, for the most part, our own fluctuating emotions, you know, just really anchoring in and finding what our personal recipe for feeling good is. So we are going to get into so much of that. I have an amazing guest coming on the show. Her name is Thea Monnier, and Thea is just a remarkable, brilliant, brilliant woman. She's a therapist. She's a spiritual teacher. She has incredible programs that she does on decolonizing mental health, healing with joy, that are available on her Instagram and her website. She's done some really incredible campaigns, and she and I actually met. Well, I'll save this for her, but let me finish giving you the beautiful rundown on her. So she is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a writer, and a creative whose work stems from her unwavering commitment to healing and her belief that true healing can only occur in a liberated and non-oppressive society. She is the host of Shaping the Shift podcast and the director of decolonialization for the multimedia platform Black Girl Mixtape, as well as a curator of the Black or the Brain Decolonizing Mental Health series. And Thea is currently featured as a GoDaddy maker to discuss mental health in marginalized communities and accessing joy and pleasure. So without further ado, here she is, Thea.
Hey, Debbie. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, so excited. Anytime I get to so talk excited. To you, girl, I am like, I am all in, clear the day.
Yes, let's do it. We promised that we would do this often, so we're keeping our promise.
Yes. So, Thea, I was saving this story. Let me give a little background on how Thea and I met, guys.
Yes.
So we were actually at the amazing Mylik Teal's retreat. That is my boo. Love me some Mylik. She hosts a yearly beautiful retreat, and we were there. And Thea and I, we were in Mexico, and I remember one of the days, I think it was towards the end of our time there, I went out to the beach, and I saw you and one of your girlfriends standing in the water. And I was like, I want to go talk to them. So I just like walked over to you guys and I was like, can I join you in the ocean?
Yes. That was so beautiful too. Like, it was great. It was perfect timing.
Yes. And you guys welcomed me in. And then we all just started talking about all the things as we're like literally wading in the water.
Yeah. Spirituality, motherhood, like, which makes sense because we were literally standing with Yemaya. So all those things naturally came forward.
And we just, we connected really deeply, and we have built and kept that friendship going. Yeah. And I shared with everyone so many of the incredible things that you do and so much of the brilliance that you embody. And so I was so excited to have you on the show. So Thea, let's like get into the meat of some of this. Like, we're going to talk about the really...
All the stuff. I love it.
We're going to talk about all the yummy stuff as it relates to joy. But, you know, let's talk about, you're also a licensed therapist, and you're somebody who is deeply spiritual and deeply connected and intuitive and really embedded in so much ritual. And so what I love is, you know, the deep, I guess what we'd call like more scientific background to healing.
Right.
And then also, you know, the beautiful understanding of how the divine heals outside of our own personal inquisitions of self. So when we think about, especially for the BIPOC community, when we think about the role, you know, mental health, much like wellness, are incredibly on trend right now. I mean, my God.
Right.
They are just these trigger words that are said so often, and so often it's not really understood what the meaning is. Like, you know, the things we keep hearing are, you know, destigmatize mental health, or, you know, care about your wellness. And it's like nobody is fully unpacking like how to do that, because the conversation so far surpasses just saying like, go to therapy, girl, find you a therapist. Right. It so far surpasses that. It's so much deeper than that. And as someone that has gone to therapy off and on for the last decade, you know, something that's so incredible, because there's always more to know about the movement to decolonize mental health is, when I even reflect back on previous therapy sessions, I'm like, oh my God, like being informed of the effect of colonialization on the way we experience ourselves, on the way we connect to spirituality, connect to therapy, it is such a massive role that mm-hmm. it is so understandable how someone could say, I've been in therapy for 10 years and they haven't even healed, you know, necessarily a lot of the things they went in to heal. Because the effects of colonialization are not really clearly understood, most definitely by the patient, but really by most therapists that you go and speak to.
I would say, vast majority. And even if they understand it, it's not sanctioned within the field of mental health to even discuss or unpack.
So what does it mean to decolonize mental health?
So thank you for everything. I mean, for laying that out, for having me here. I'm so honored. You were definitely one of the big gifts that I left that retreat with, and it just continues to be a blessing. So thank you. Thank you for even, you know, having this conversation as we're raising awareness, because you're right, like these words like wellness and mental health come up. And when we see things become on trend like that, we can pretty much safely assume they've only entered the mainstream because they've been sanctioned by whiteness, which means they've been sanctioned by that same colonial energy. They've been colonized, right? The concepts themselves have been colonized. And so we have to begin with thinking about the fact that mental health, as we practice it and as we see it, originated within white culture, within specifically thinking about European white culture, specifically thinking about affluent European white culture, right? That's a very narrow group of people that now when we say to somebody, go get therapy, girl, those aren't the people who were intended to receive this practice. And yet we're now mandating it for people without expanding the field to include their values and their perspectives and their stories and their ancestry. It's not that prior to that, there weren't ways within our communities of managing emotion, dealing with mental health. Usually a lot of those things dealt with community. It was viewed as a community issue if somebody was going through something. Like, what are we not offering them? What do they need? How can we support? And so when you look back pre-colonial dates, it's not that you don't see strategies for wellness or for mental health or for spiritual health. It's just that they were more communal and they were more integrated. So it's not like we gave them a separate name or a separate category. It was built into what we were eating. It was built into how we were relating with each other. It was built into how we were relating to nature. And so separating it out in and of itself is already an indication that you started to encounter Western thought as dominant thought, right? So the idea that mental health is separate from, you know, folks' religions and their spirituality or how they prepare their food or how they sit at the kitchen table, that for us, all of these things are truly mental health. What can we name that doesn't have an impact on our mental health, right?
Right.
So, right. Like, so mental health is actually everything and everywhere. It's not in this space or in this office, except it's only seemed as valid and it's only labeled as that when it happens within a framework that has been constructed by that affluent white European ideal, right? Wow. So what we say decolonize mental health, what we're saying is, let's go back. Really what we're saying is, let's decolonize the society, to be honest, because mental health is everywhere. We're saying, let's go back to a time when my humanity was so valid, I didn't need a therapist. Let's go back to values that when I'm sick, people don't look at me and say something's wrong with me. They say, what's wrong with us and how can we work on that together? That's really the ultimate battle cry of what we're saying with decolonizing mental health. But we're challenging the field first because it is a buzzword and because it can penetrate all areas of our life.
Yeah. Give me, if you would, let's help illustrate this further, especially for people that may be listening that haven't even, that are not on a therapy journey per se.
Sure.
So when I think about, and please correct me your understanding, but if I think about how I've experienced colonialism in therapy, it would be like, say I go into my therapist and I want to talk about things I'm experiencing in the workplace. You know, maybe I am really starting to feel a certain level of worthlessness or anxiety or anxiousness in dealing with some coworkers where I work. And, you know, there might be microaggressions happening at work and, you know, all of these different little things that are sometimes invisible to the naked eye, but you feel it and you know you know, when some things are because you're a woman or because of your race, or, you know, there is a tone, there is a there's a deeper intuitiveness in that. And so I may be talking to my therapist about it, and she might be helping me unpack it, right? She might be like, well, so tell me, so how does that make you feel? Or tell me, you know, what comes up for you when that person does that? But then there's this elephant in the room that we haven't talked about, which is perhaps what I'm intuiting is valid based on systemic racism, based on colonialism, based on, you know, all of the systems of oppression in place against women, against people of color. And so actually, like, instead of me navigating how to just focus on myself and my role in things, it's like calling out, well, your boss is most likely, you know, bigoted or racist, or, you know, this might be male aggression, or, and I'm making this scenario completely up. But, you know, it's like it's those unspoken elephants in the room that are the effect of colonialism that don't get talked about when you're in a session. And so what I found is so many of us walk around, especially up until recently, the last couple of years when we've been having these expansive conversations, so many of us walk around and it's as if everything is our fault, or as if you're imagining, or as if it's like somehow I was just born into this hole that I can't climb out of. And when you go to get help and you go to get resources, people are only directing you to understand what you can do differently, what you can do better, but without validating that your experience is such because of all of the systems and structures in place.
So crystal clear, perfect example, right? Perfect example. And so because you laid that out so well, what I can now do is go back and point out all the spaces that something should have and could have been done differently, right? So the first thing is, when we assess clients, when they're coming in for mental health services, we need to ask questions about systemic oppression, systemic racism. Have you experienced it? How has it shown up in your life? You know, what are your feelings about these things? That already acknowledges that what you're coming in here to work on, there's a portion of it that wouldn't exist if we were in a different society that valued different things, right? So one of the things I always say is, if I took somebody from this society and put them in a more affirming society, and 90% of their issues go away, right? 90% of the anxiety, the depression, the self-worth, right? The feelings I have to be productive, I have to be on all the time, because I move them into a non-capitalistic, affirming, non-racialized society, then it's never been the person's illness. The person is actually demonstrating and screaming out for the society to recognize its own illness. We are reflecting back that illness, right? And so when you do therapy the way it's set up in a colonized way, is they don't have the tools or the language to even assess for it, because it's very problem centered and problem focused. And so you do leave there feeling like, one, they've never named systemic oppression, they've never named racism, they've never said, hey, are, you know, we do, and not even asking, right? Because they would say, do you think it's racism? No, don't say that. Say, well, we know that we live in a society that is rooted in anti-blackness. And we know that corporations and businesses set up a model based on plantations, right? That is the model for modern day business. And you can listen to that back in the 1619 project. That's how we establish business, right? That's how we establish the workplace off of plantations. So we know that these are the facts. And as a therapist, I feel like it's important that I state those facts. I'm not even going to ask you that question, right? Do you think it could be, right? Because then it's like still on you, right? It's like, no, well, let's just call a thing, right? And that is playing a role in what you're experiencing. Or it could be, because maybe that person isn't ready to admit that it could be about racism. And they're like, oh, well, maybe I never, because we don't always give ourselves permission, because we don't think it'll be validated, right? Or valued.
Right.
So exactly what you said, what that person should have done is they should have walked it into the room. You shouldn't have had to. And before you even, as if you identified as a person of color, then in your assessment, there should have been information and things that signaled to you that it was okay to discuss this in a racialized way. And so those are some of the steps that we're trying to put into the processes when we think about the back of the brain, because that makes all the difference in the world. Because then you're not going to tell me to just go deep breathe and drink some water. You're going to tell me to that I'm valuable and I'm valid. Yes. And what I'm experiencing is real, and not leave me. And that is enough sometimes. Not leave me walking away from your office wondering if I'm crazy or feeling so vulnerable that I expose myself in this way, you know?
Yeah. And you know, so much of like the process of transforming ourselves, whether that is through therapy or that's through our own spiritual practices. But, you know, very often in the beginning, it's like you are looking up at this giant mountain and you're saying, how the hell will I scale this? How do I even attempt to climb this mountain? I'm now getting downloads of all the things out of alignment in my life, of all the traumas I've experienced and their effects. And how do I even attempt this, you know?
Yes.
And I think from what you were saying, so much, if there is more of a thoughtfulness and the implementation of these understandings that you've shared within all therapy and therapized, I don't know if that's the word, environment, you know, then that would, it's not a mountain anymore, because it's not about you. Yeah, it's not, not just about you. You're understanding your role in the collective. And so then there's opportunity to find peace. That even though these systems exist, we're in the process, as always, of trying to dismantle them. But, you know, these systems have been in place since the inception of society as a construct. It would help us, you know, understand how to still access joy and worth and meaning in our lives, even if these systems are still in place.
And power. And self-authorization.
And personal power.
So
yes.
Part of what you have to ask as a practitioner, any sort of practitioner, because wellness, if you're a yoga instructor, you cannot work with black bodies in yoga the way you work with white bodies in yoga. We carry different things. Mm. And so does your practice, your yoga practice, understand that?
Yeah.
Does what you're teaching accommodate for what we're storing in our hips and our bodies? Does your yoga practice accommodate people who were once enslaved and could not authorize within their own bodies, right? So it gives them peace, right? Because there's the validation, but it also gives them power. Like to walk out of that space and be like, I'm not crazy. You're crazy. This is crazy. Toni Morrison said racism is neurotic. It is psychotic. It is crazy and it feels crazy. And she's accurate in that. But we, when we put it on the people who are experiencing it, then we are saying, no, it's not that. It's not crazy. You're crazy, which is gaslighting, right?
Yeah.
So then here we are as people who are here to help, as people who have good intentions, but we're being used as an extension of a system to gaslight people back into what? Work. Back into work, back into line, back into capitalism, back into the same plantation system that we all grew up in, right? And so that power piece is so important, because that begs the question, if you are a healing practitioner, no matter what area of wellness you find yourself in, who do you work for? Do you work for the society, or do you work for the liberation of the people that you're serving? Because those are two very different ballgames.
Mm.
If I work for the society, then all I'm trying to do is get this person calm and centered enough to go back to work and functioning. But if I work for this person, then I don't just want them to leave at peace and at ease. I want them to leave empowered and self-authorizing, because I recognize that the only way the work that I'm doing makes sense is if one day it heals everything. I have to be able to envision a world that's not sick. And if I'm a healer, and that's what I say I'm committed to, it's not just about this person. It's about making sure this person is equipped to go back out into that world and say, no, I'm not the sick one. And in doing that, that I need to be challenging that system and saying it's sick.
Yes.
I need to be calling it out, right? Because my goal is to heal us all.
Yeah.
Unless my goal is just to sit here and play my role within the system.
Yes. God, and what you just spoke to, first of all, it's all so damn powerful. So let me just sit in that for a second. Wow. So you know what I'm really hearing from this too, and this isn't, I didn't even learn to apply this word to myself in the last couple of years, and I didn't even see where it applied to moments in my life, but a big part of the experience of being non-white in America is just not understanding how to, having permission to, or even knowing that you can advocate for yourself. Self-advocation has changed everything about my life. And mm-hmm. what it really is, it builds up your confidence and your personal mm-hmm. power when you're able to exercise it in real time. And so what I'm hearing mm-hmm. from a lot of what you were sharing is even just the knowledge and being mm-hmm. validated that these systems are at play and are at work, that awareness then empowers you to in every moment advocate otherwise. In every moment, absolutely. Call out things in real time and have the confidence in doing so and in understanding what these structures are. And in knowing when you are being mistreated, even at a mm-hmm. micro level, because the mistreatment mm-hmm. in this country doesn't just happen on those macro levels. It's not
right.
It's not the big moments, you know, all the time right. where you're walking down the street and someone maybe calls you the N-word or, you know, right. some man, you know, without consent tries to touch you or mm-hmm. Belittles you because you don't want to give them attention. It's usually in those tiny little macro ways, mm-hmm. those little quick little words or tones or, you know, mm-hmm. body language and being able to be equipped with that awareness and build up that personal power of advocating for yourself when you feel mistreated or calling things out in real time. That mm-hmm. is what, you know, ideally you should be walking out of a therapy session building in yourself. That mm-hmm. should be the muscle you're building, how to stand in your truth, how to know what's real and true and what isn't and what's programming. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is where you're going to love this, because this is where the spirituality piece comes in, right? This is why when we talk about decolonizing mental health, we are simultaneously talking about activating ancestral practices and integrating spirituality, right? Because, okay, when that person walks out affirmed, right, and validated, without even my help after that point, there's a natural process where that third chakra begins to activate, right? That sense of self, that sense of autonomy and authority. And what can support that further is your spiritual practice, right? So for me, I practice Afro-spirituality partly because I get to see energies in the form of Black women who walk around and are like, I can't even feel your evil that you're trying to throw at me. I don't even recognize this as valid. Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, yeah. I can't even to walk around in so much power. And I couldn't find examples of that in Western spiritual practices. But there's so many in Afro spirituality that, like, when I'm like, when I go from that therapist's office and then I pick up a book on Oya or on Oshun or on Yamaya, I'm like, and I'm like, I can do that, right? I can authorize myself in that way. You know, it's so interesting to watch. I mean, even, you know, we've been going through election stuff, but like I'm watching the self-authorization of people and them self-liberate. And I, a cohort member, Donisha Lawson-Satt, is a part of our The Black or the Brain cohort. And we have these ongoing conversations about this. I mean, you're going to have to come talk to this cohort, Debbie.
I cannot
for sure.
wait.
Yeah, it's great. You're going to love it. They're brilliant. And she was like, I just want to be clear that what we are advocating for is not emancipation. It's liberation, right? Emancipation is waiting for someone to come free you. And I do feel like a lot of us have been trained and conditioned to wait for emancipation, right?
Oh, my gosh. I feel like that's so many. And it comes in so many forms, right? Like, not even yes. just in the historical context of, like, being emancipated, right? Like,
right.
like being told you can be free instead of right. knowing you are free. But then also, right. especially for women, down to, you know, the simplest things like growing up on Disney movies and cartoons that
right.
that say that,
waiting
you know,
to be rescued.
I'm Sleeping Beauty and someone came to free me, or, you know, I'm
yes,
Rapunzel
absolutely.
And someone came to free me and that was my only means of being free. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And so she highlighted that, and that we are actively rooted in liberation, meaning people, we believe people have the power to self-authorize and self-govern, right? And self-liberate. So part of what we have to know, though, is most of the people we're dealing with have been trained and conditioned for emancipation, which is why our role as healers is so important. In that moment, we are engaging in an act of emancipation because that's what they've been conditioned for. But then we have to set them up to sustain their liberation from that point forward, right? And so when they bring in their ancestral practices and they bring in their ideas and they bring in so many beautiful aspects of themselves and their individuality, it is our job to continue to affirm and build with that. Not to say, well, I don't know. I think Freud would have done it this way. fuck Freud. They're not talking about Freud. He's not in this session. You know what I'm saying? We're talking about you and your life, you know? And everything you're saying is completely valid. Let's build it in. And I'll bring my knowledge, and you bring your knowledge, and I bring my ancestors, and you bring my ancestors. And this is what decolonized therapy is, right? Like, we all here, family, community, spiritual, and in the physical world, working together towards a healing moment, a healing opportunity. You know, what the A Course in Miracles says is a miracle. This healing moment of revelation where we see each other as we truly are. That's it. That's all we're trying to create. And we cannot do that through a colonized lens.
Yeah. Oof. Woof. Woof. Everybody listening, is your iPhone on fire right now? Wow. Talk to me about Black or the Brain cohort.
Cohort.
Because I know so many people listening. Yes. I mean, this is something so revolutionary, and I know so many of the listeners of this show are going to be like, I need to add this to cart. Like, give me this.
I'm so excited about it. And let me tell you, you're already, like, Blacker the Brain in it. I'm just letting you know. I mean, I haven't.
Period.
You're honorary.
me and you, we go together. So we are going to be, we're going to be weaved into all of one another's projects.
I just assume, I'm like, Debbie's a part of the cohort.
Period.
So the Blacker the Brain is a movement, you know, and I had to accept that name. It was actually one of our cohort members that described it that way. And I was like, that feels like a lot. And then I was like, okay, that's what it is, right? It is a movement.
I hear Tupac in that a little bit. The black or the berry, the sweeter
the juice, right? Yeah. Exactly. It totally influenced, right? And so it's a conversation, an ongoing conversation. We have a cohort and we have a campaign, right? So the campaign is this part of just like building awareness about what do we mean when we say decolonizing mental health? What are we talking about? And then we use that to engage people into the conversations, which are lecture series that you can tap into. We do them like once every 6 weeks. And the next one we have coming up is called Free to Heal, which is like the practices. What would it look like to decolonize all your practices? Now, here's the thing. What I love, love, love about the Black of the Brain, the first thing about it is it's not just about mental health, even though it's called the Black of the Brain. It's interdisciplinary. We have teachers, educators, professors, physicians, people in tech. Our cohort is so amazing because what? Mental health is everywhere. Mm. If you work at a grocery store, I would love for you to be a part of the Black of the Brain because how a person's treated in customer service impacts their mental health. I can't think of a single area or person that could be left out of this conversation. And the more we get people from these different spaces, the more beautiful it becomes. And so the cohort is interdisciplinary, multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-identities. We have such a good time because we are joy-centered in our work. And we're badass about it. Like, you can be both, right? Like, you can be, you know, joy is our metric as we're creating these concepts and these ideas about how can we create a plan for families who have a person in their family suffering from a mental health illness so that they don't have to call the police and run that risk as a Black body, right?
Wow.
But we're creating that, but we're centering joy in that process so that everything we produce brings joy and power to the people who are using these tools and these strategies. So it's expansive. Like, I just feel like next year with this group that we have, you're going to see like documentation, presentations, curriculum. You're going to see mentorship where we're working with our new little therapy babies who are coming up through the grad programs. We're going to catch them early, decolonize them early.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's just... it's everything. It's so beautiful. It's like my favorite thing to talk about right now. Clearly.
I love it. I love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Please, guys. And I put this at the beginning of the show, but you got to connect with Thea. Like, you got to head to her Instagram. You got to head to your website.
I'm here.
Talk to me about joy. Let's talk about healing with joy. So top of the show, I shared some of my experiences with really expanding my capacity for joy. And the way that I really did that was by leaning into the tiny joys of every day in each moment. And so feeling deep gratitude and presence and anchoring in, you know, when the sun hits my skin or, you know, catching being able to like look my son in his eyes and, you know, smile at one another or all of the moments that are not grand. I think so often we think, oh, joy, that sounds big. That actually maybe sounds bigger than happy. And so that means like, you know, like a 3-day stay at Disneyland, or that means, you know, some giant celebration, or And joy is, for me, that deep aboding and that embodiment. Mm-hmm. So talk to me, how does one, number one, heal through joy? But number two, if joy is not even in your emotional Rolodex, right. if it's not in right. your mental Rolodex, how does mm-hmm. one begin to court joy, to flirt yes. with joy, to invite joy in?
You know, I'm trying to think, where do we begin with this? Because joy is so expansive to me. Mm. There's so many things. Okay, joy is healing. Joy is transformational. And joy is a metric. So joy is healing is really important for us to discuss when we're talking to BIPOC communities who have weaved the story of struggle into their story of resilience, because we tend to remember the harder things more than we remember the beautiful things.
Yeah.
And at times, even in the hard things, it were these small, beautiful things that sustained us. But let's talk about that for a quick second. If we're in the middle of all this hard stuff, and this one beautiful thing was enough to sustain us, that actually means that the beautiful thing was more powerful, so powerful that it was not even necessary to have a large dose of it to even sustain your generation or the generation that came after you. So joy is transformational. It's a very powerful tool. It's a very powerful weapon. Right? It's something that you don't need to have in large doses in order to maintain and sustain a brilliant, beautiful life. But you have permission to access larger doses if you want to. And the key for most people, like you're saying, is we have been, again, even thinking about mental health, even thinking about our school systems, even thinking about our workplaces, they're conditioned to look at problems. They're not conditioned to identify what makes me happy, what feels good. They're not conditioned towards embodiment. They're not conditioned towards healthy relationships with bodies. So, and joy, you really experience joy first in your body. So joy requires a relationship with your body.
Ah.
Because then you feel, you see what I'm saying? You
That's
feel
it.
Like that.
Yeah.
That now taking back to, going back to people who have been disenfranchised,
who couldn't
own their own bodies.
And speaking to the point you made earlier, too, about being in yoga or being, you know, I would lead meditations early in that piece of my career. And I would go into a room and I'd say, all right, let's gently close our eyes. And no one could close their eyes. Staring at me, you know, just in what felt like terror almost. Because when you close your eyes, you're inside of yourself and you're vulnerable and you don't necessarily feel safe in you. And so to that point, I thought that was just an incredible illustration of how deep that goes, how robbed we have been of joy and of even knowing how to access it, how foreign it feels.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have to. So in order to access joy, we have to reclaim our DNA. Mm. And in order to reclaim our DNA, we have to reclaim our bodies and every cell. And I do love the practice of yoga, especially when practiced through a decolonized lens, because it does just that. It creates this embodiment. I love the practice of dance because it does that. I love the practice of Reiki because it does that. And I love massage therapy. All these things say it's safe to return to your body. We know that trauma sort of pushes you out of your body, ejects you from your body. And when it's happening repeatedly, you just find a new home outside of your own body for safety reasons.
Hold on, sit there for a second. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? Unpack that, please.
Yeah, I think what it means is like when we talk about systemic oppression, and I hope no matter who wins this election, we must continue to now pay attention to, can we now look at the true effects of this thing called racism, of this thing called slavery? Because what it means is that for centuries, Black people weren't just forced to flee and be away from their homes. They were forced to flee their bodies, which were their homes. And now their home is this somewhere in the mind, which isn't a place of their own construction, right? And so there's this idea that if I go back into my body, I have to feel not just my pain, but my great-great-grandmother's pain. I have to feel not just my pain, but I have to feel Emmett Till's mother's pain. I have to feel you know, Trayvon Martin, Sabrina Fulton. I have to feel all these, this pain. So why do that? Why be in my body? And then when we look at health outcomes and we try to say, well, don't eat this and don't do that, I don't even feel when I'm full. I don't even know what it feels like in my body to have high blood pressure because I'm not there. It's safer to not be there. When I'm there, people are staring at me. When I'm there, people are assuming things about me. When I'm, but to turn that off, just to be able to continue to function in a racist society, that is a sickness that we have created, that has been created, that is man-made, right? Which means we can repair it. And so I start by helping people with embodiment. I don't think you can do decolonized mental health without working with embodiment practitioners, which we have many in the Blacker the Brain, because it's something about saying, even if you don't deem your body safe yet, it's not not safe because of you. It's not safe because of what's happening outside of you. And so you deserve to occupy your space because it is not your body's fault that it's not deemed a safe place. And the only way we're going to get it to move to a safer place is if you feel empowered enough to inhabit it and then to demand while you're in it pleasure and joy. And that is liberation. That is liberation. And it can happen if you are anywhere at any given time, but it begins with that return. And so sometimes I use food with people to help them slow down and catch that. But usually what I do is use joy as a metric. So I'll say joy is that feeling you get when everything is like really clear, right? It's like, whoo, you just feel this perfect alignment. It's like almost floating. And we do get moments of that, but we move through it so quickly because we're not embodied that we don't sustain that feeling of joy and we don't know what it means. We don't know that we have the power to stretch it out or to make it a lifestyle. And so it's, I tell them when, for, so what they do know though, how you can teach them about joy in their bodies real quick is they know what discomfort feels like. They're very used to that, right? So what I'll do is tell them, and I learned this exercise working with restorative justice, hold a no in your body while nodding yes, and then hold a yes in your body while nodding no. That incongruence that you feel, that is the opposite of joy.
Hold on. Take a second, everybody listening. I want you to gently close your eyes if it's safe where you are. Take a breath in through your nose. Hold it at the top. And let's exhale through our mouths. And let's do that one more time. We're going to take a deep breath in. Hold it at the top. Exhale through the mouth. Breath in. Now with your eyes still gently closed, I want you to think and connect to the feeling of no. So first, let's just think and connect to saying no inside of ourselves. And as we're saying no inside of ourselves, let's nod our head yes. Now let's clear that energy out, and I want you to say yes inside of yourself. I want you to feel enthusiastic about this yes. It's a yes, yes, yes. Say that inside the deepest place possible. Yes. And as you're feeling that yes and saying yes enthusiastically, shake your head no. Thea, describe for everyone what they're feeling when they do that. What is that feeling of disalignment?
When I've done this with people, and thank you so much for beautifully leading us through that. I love that.
And gently open your eyes, everyone. Thank you.
When they do the when they have the yes in their body and they're nodding no, it feels like a silliness. Like it's more like, oh, that's silly. Why would I say no when I want to say yes? It's kind of, it's a little lighter than the energy of holding the no and saying yes. That feels heavier. That feels a little bit more harsh. And I tell people, that's your ancestors. Because what I don't want them to create, I'm trying to rewire this negative relationship with hard feelings in the body. Mm. If I label it anxiety, depression, trauma, then they're going to run from it. But if I say, what if that's your ancestor saying, whoa, 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 where are you going? Why are you saying yes to something you clearly don't want to do? Mm. Then it's a relationship. Then it's loving, right? And so,
and that's how you begin to learn like that healthy boundaries and what that is, how to set those boundaries for yourself. Yeah.
And that's how you rework your relationship with the hard things. Mm. That the hard things aren't things that we run from. They're things that are giving us signals too. They're telling us, just like Joy says, ha, you found the right spot. But we couldn't find the right spot if we didn't have that discomfort telling us this is not the right spot, right? They're not opposites. They're working together to lead us where we should be. And so that joy is the finding that spot, but it takes a discomfort sometimes to move us and nudge us there. Mm. And if we judge that, if we have a judgment against what that feeling is and we shut down and we deem it unsafe, then we will not be able to use it to move us to where we should be. Mm-hmm. And then we can start using joy as a metric. So now when we are not feeling joy, we know we're not in the right spot, right? And then we can decide moment by moment how to line ourselves up so and when I run into spaces that I've created in joy, but then I have a moment of discomfort, I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. First, let me check. Did I accidentally let white supremacy, capitalism, or patriarchy in the room? Because I might have. It might have snuck in, right? So let me check for that first. The other thing is I may be limiting how I'm looking at a situation, which is also a byproduct of white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy, right? I may be saying, oh, only these solutions are possible. So it's a call to my creativity. Mm. You know, that lack of joy means, oh, be more creative. Make something up. Try something new. All of those nudges are super helpful. And if we use joy as a metric, we can build a life. Mm. And I promise you this, that literally is joyful. And when it's not, because we're doing something wrong. It's just information that our ancestors are bringing us to nudge us towards the joy.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, I hate to do this because I want to talk here the whole time. But I have an ask of you. But first, please let everyone know how they can connect with you.
Absolutely. Sure. So my company is called Marley Ayo, MarleyAyo. Ayo means joy in Yoruba. So that has information on the Black Earth, the brain. That has information on all the things our company is working on. I'm on Instagram at Thea Monier, at the Black Earth, the brain. There's so many ats, right? At Shaping the Shift podcast, which you can catch up on the episode where we had Debbie on. Yes. So if you like this, you can go listen to that and get like a double dose, like part one and part two. I'm super easy to access.
And we'll drop all the links below in the posting wherever you are catching this show. So as we end the show, I love to walk away with everyone having a little soul work. So an intention that they can connect to an assignment, maybe, you know, a journaling prompt or some tips. But for the next week, before we get to our next episode, Thea, if you would share a little soul work that everyone can do to spend this next week, if you do not connect yet fully to joy, a little bit of homework of how the audience can really begin to taste it.
One, I would say replay that meditation that Devi just led you through, because that's a great way to get accustomed to what that feels like in your body. So once you've done that a couple of times and you're like, ugh, I know that feeling, catch those feelings throughout the day. Maybe you're about to wash dishes and you feel that feeling come up. So then you say, when you feel the ugh, wait a minute, does this bring me joy to do these dishes right now? If not, give yourself permission to not do those dishes. See how that feels, right? See what comes up with that. If you decide you want to push through the dishes, then that you have to do so finding a way to frame it with joy. Maybe you're saying, well, I'll wash the dishes even though I don't want to, because I want to have a really great meal with my family later on today. And you tap into that joy, right? Yeah. But don't move forward until you've figured out a way to either frame it with joy or giving yourself permission to not do it at all, right? And whenever you feel the little ugh, that's like your key, like, ooh, I'm about to engage in something. I'm about to do it. I'm saying yes when I want to say no, right? And practice asking, well, does this bring me joy? And how can I make it bring me joy? Or how can I just decide I don't want to do this right now because it would not bring me joy? And that is also an exercise in self-authorization.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good, you guys. Really deepen into that soul work this week until we get to the next episode. Thea, thank you so much for joining
My pleasure, Debbie. Thank you. Anytime, you know, whenever you call, I'm running. I'm running.
Likewise, girl.
VIP.
Everyone, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the show, and I'll catch you next week. I love you. Hey, find me on social. Let's connect. At Debbie Brown, that's Twitter and Instagram, or go to my website, debbiebrown.com. And if you're listening to this show on Apple Podcasts, please, please, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And send this episode to a friend. Dropping Gems is a production of iHeartRadio and the Black Effect Network. It's produced by Tribble and me, Debbie Brown. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.